Several weeks ago, Mr. Mickelson had a sermon that was entitled, "It's Not How You Start the Race That Counts." And what this title implies is that the finish is what is truly important. So my title today is Finish Strong. Mr. Mickelson cited examples of several kings of ancient Judah who started strong. They accomplished a lot. They accomplished a lot toward the restoration of the worship of God and the rooting out of paganism in their nation. They had very promising beginnings, but through pride or other problems, they faltered in their progress and did not finish as strong as they could have. They didn't have very happy endings. Now, I'm sure all well aware that these days of unleavened bread recall the time that the children of Israel started their journey, call it a race, you could, as they marched out of slavery in Egypt and they headed for the land that God promised Abraham. They started out with a high hand. This day, the last day of unleavened bread, is reckoned by some to be the actual day that they crossed the Red Sea on dry ground. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But still, it's a very joyful occasion that this day represents. Moses composed a song of victory and triumph and praise to God for this deliverance and this protection, and there was much rejoicing throughout Israel. But I'm sure we're also all very well aware of the fact that trials and problems ensued, and that with the exception of two faithful men, that whole adult generation of Israelites, where there was reckoned to be something like 600,000 men, every one of them died in the wilderness. None of them crossed the finish line, except for those two faithful men. Today, let's look at the finish line and focus on those who did cross it, who did finish strong. This race, this journey that began with the first day of unleavened bread leaving Egypt, did finish out at this very same time of the year. We're going to be focusing specifically on these few individuals who did finish strong and whose lives had particularly happy endings. And I'm kind of a sucker for happy endings myself. But hopefully we can gain some inspiration through their example and apply it to circumstances in our life. I'd like to start today in the book of Deuteronomy. If you would please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 1. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 1, it kind of sets the stage for when these events were occurring. Deuteronomy 1 verse 3 says, "It came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him as commandments to them." So we're here at the first day of the 11th month. So that gives us about 2 months to the end of the year, 2.5 months till Passover in the days of unleavened bread. So you can see it's right in this springtime, right about this time of year. And in verse 5, it gives us the place where this occurred. On verse 5, it says, "This side of the Jordan, in the land of Moab, Moses began to explain the law." So they had not crossed the Jordan River yet. They had not begun the invasion of Canaan land. They were still on the east side. They were encamped in a flat, desolate place called the Plains of Moab. And they were across the Jordan River from Jericho. Jericho was up the hill 5 or 6 miles on the other side. Now, in order to help us to understand this and other examples that we read of in Scripture, I'd like to do a little bit of geography here, help us to understand the lay of the land. Now, the land of Canaan that they were going to occupy, you may understand, was bordered on one side, on the west side, by the Mediterranean Sea. On the east side, there was a very deep valley, and it was called the Arabah, which runs north and south, roughly parallel to the Mediterranean Sea. This land was about 35 to 60 miles wide, depending on where you are, and it was about 150 miles north to south. So that was the land that the Canaanites occupied. Starting in the north, the most striking features would be the Sea of Galilee, and then the Jordan River, and then the Dead Sea furthest to the south. Now, the Dead Sea is about 11 miles wide and about 55 miles long. So it's just about like driving from Spokane to Ritzville. You can see it's a fairly decent-sized body of water. How many of you have been to Death Valley? Okay. When you go to Death Valley, there's a very interesting spot that you want to visit. And it's called Badwater. And when you stand at Badwater, it's a little pool of water surrounded by all kinds of salt rock. And when you stand there, you look up the side of the hill, and way up on the side of the hill there's a white sign. And the white sign says sea level. And that kind of gives you the creeps. I mean, you know, if you were someplace else, you'd be under 282 feet of water. That's how deep Death Valley is. Now, the Dead Sea is a full 1,000 feet lower. The surface of the Dead Sea is something like 1,300 feet below sea level. It is the deepest spot in the world. And like Death Valley, it is very hot. The Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea from the north, and there are two or three other smaller streams that flow in from the mountains to the east, but there's no outlet in the lake. All this water is flowing in. Doesn't flow out. It evaporates. It's that hot. As it evaporates, of course, it leaves all the minerals behind, and so the Salt Sea is another name for the Dead Sea. It is 9 times salter than the ocean, and nothing except for a few brine shrimp live in it. Now, the Jordan River that flows through the Jordan Valley, as I mentioned it, to the north end of the Dead Sea, it's about 65 miles up to the Sea of Galilee. The Jordan River is about 90 to 100 feet wide and from 3 to 12 feet deep. But at this time of year, it overflows its banks. All the snow melt and everything from the high mountains. At flood stage, it's about 200 yards to a mile wide. And it is quite a substantial flow of water. They say it's rapid and it's muddy. Now, the north end of the Jordan Valley is, as I mentioned, the Sea of Galilee, and that's a little, well, it's a freshwater lake, and it's about 8 by 13 miles. And it's the lowest freshwater lake in the world, even that far upstream from the Dead Sea. It's still 680 feet below sea level. So you see, this Araba is a very hot, desolate place. It's not very inhabitable at all. So he says we're on this side of the Jordan, again, just a few miles north of where the Jordan flows into the Dead Sea. The river flats out a bit, and it's actually fordable. There's a couple places where you can walk across it, and so it's part of the trade route that goes through that valley. They didn't have bridges back then. So this 40th year we're talking about, though, is the 40th year of the wandering of the children of Israel. And you pretty much know the story, how Moses had sent 12 men when God first led them to the promised land to reconnoiter the land, check it out, before they invaded it. And these men, 10 of the men, came back with negative report. And the Israelites refused to go and occupy the land. Moses mentions this in verse 25 of chapter 1 here, where it says, they took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us, and they brought back word to us, saying, it's a good land which the Lord our God is giving us. Nevertheless, you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, he's brought us out to the land of Egypt, to deliver us to the land of the Amorites, to destroy us. For these people refused to obey God, and they began that those years of wandering, during which that whole generation, all the adult people, failed to finish. They had begun that race with a joyful high hand, and they refused to finish, cross that finish line. There were only two faithful men, as I mentioned in verse 36. Well, you can start in verse 35 that says, "Surely not one of these men of this evil generation shall see that good land which I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and his children I'm giving the land on which he walked, because he wholly followed the Lord." So wholly following God in whatever he commands, will enable us to cross the finish line in grand style. Moses says in verse 37, "The Lord was also angry with me for your sakes, saying, even you shall not go in there." Moses failed to cross the finish line. 38, "But Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall go there. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it." So Moses went on to describe through the book of Deuteronomy other occasions that of their history during that 40 years, brought the people in remembrance of the good times and the bad times that they had. But his main emphasis was to learn from their experiences and not make those mistakes again. He wanted to encourage them to trust God. Put God first, as Mr. Mickelson would say. This book of Deuteronomy is considered to be either a sermon of Moses or possibly a series of three sermons because of the way it's arranged. But it is a very incredible, very important book in the Bible. Moses told them to put God first, as we always hear. But the difficulty with putting God first was that there were many gods in competition. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Read the first three verses here. "When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor their daughter for your son." Now, many sincere people look at the passages such as this, and they conclude that the God of the Old Testament was a harsh and vindictive God who sanctioned the wholesale slaughter of these nations. People who do not keep these holy days as God commanded do not understand his plan. God's plan is for the salvation of all mankind, and one day these people will be resurrected and given the opportunity to know God, given a chance to repent, to change their lives, and become part of God's eternal family. But at this point in history, these people would be a stumbling block to the children of Israel. God wanted Israel to be a model nation, to be holy, dependent on him and dedicated to him, as Caleb was. But he understood that the gods of the Canaanites and the other nations there would prevent many of them, of his people, from finishing strong as he wanted them to do. In verse 4 it says, "They will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly." So God was telling them, if they don't destroy these pagan nations, God's going to destroy them. They had to clean the slate, so to speak. In verse 5, it goes on to say, "Thus shall you deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, and burn their carved images with fire." Now, Mr. Mickelson mentioned that some of the good kings of Judah did accomplish some of these things, but they didn't completely accomplish them. They failed to carry out these instructions completely as they should have. They did not completely erase all these idols. And so they left a foothold for another surge of paganism, or more insidiously, actually, a chance to syncretize that pagan religion with the worship of God. Continuing in verse 7, the Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples, but because the Lord loves you and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the house of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. In other words, they started their race the way they should have. Therefore, know the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for a thousand generations with those who love him and keep his commandments, and repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. Therefore you shall keep the commandments, the statutes, the judgments which I command you today and observe them. This is very powerful stuff. And right after this command to obey and serve God starts the blessings for obedience. And so it is a blessing to know God and to be able to serve him. And the blessings are what everybody wants. Problem is, people try to take shortcuts to get what they want. Again, let's go to chapter 12. And I want to be a little repetitious here to underscore, because that's what Moses did. We'll read the first four verses here. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your father, the God of your fathers, is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, burn their wooden images with fire. You shall cut down the carved images of their gods and destroy even their names from that place. God wanted every memory of these Canaanite gods to be destroyed. It says, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. Now in verse 5 it starts out and it says, you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his habitation, and there you shall go. There was a contrast here between the many places that the pagans worshipped to the one place where God wanted his nation in unity to worship him. And then in verse 6 it says, there you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, and your freewill offerings, and so on. So again, God wants to be worshipped by his people in unity. Now, over the years, we've heard these things alluded to. And again, that sermon Mr. Mickelson had about these kings that started out by doing these things. I've heard, I don't know if you have, you hear about this religion, the religion of the Baals and so on. And there's always, in my mind, kind of a fuzzy allusion to it, like, what was this religion all about? Well, I'd like to read a couple excerpts here from this book, Understanding the Old Testament, by Bernard W. Anderson, published by Prentice Hall. And I think it helps us understand the mindset, the philosophy behind these paganite religions. I don't know if it's exactly 100% correct, but to me it gives us an understanding of why these people thought the way they did and so on. Okay, we're talking about the worship of Baals and Ashtarts. It says the title Baal means lord or owner. It designates the male deity who owns the land and controls its fertility. And his female partner is known as Baalath, or lady, although she's generally cited by her personal name, Ashtart. So we've heard of the Baals and the Ashtarts. It was believed that these fertility powers were connected with particular localities or towns, in which case one could speak of many Baals and Ashtarts as numerous as the cities of the land. So each little area had its own Baal that it served, and they're all very, very similar. It's not like they were different. It's just that these Baals they worshipped served their local area. A modern farmer, despite his training in science of agriculture, sometimes marvels at the strange powers of fertility that work on the soil. Even yet, they call the soil Mother Earth. And I know that our TV weathermen, and they talk about Mother Nature. And it's a remnant of this pagan worship. Men of the soil have from time immemorial marveled at the astounding mysteries of nature without which there could be no agriculture. In the Fertile Crescent, where the whole culture was dependent on the fruitfulness of the soil, this mystery was viewed in a religious way. The land, it was believed, is the sphere of divine powers. The Baal of a region is the lord or owner of the land, and its fertility is dependent on sexual relations between him and his consort. When the rains came and the earth and water mingled, the mysterious powers of fertility stirred again. New life was resurrected after the barrenness of winter. This astonishing revival of nature, people believe, was due to the sexual intercourse between Baal and his partner, Baalath. Furthermore, man was not a mere spectator of this sacred marriage. It was believed that by ritually enacting the drama of Baal, it was possible to assist the fertility powers to reach their consummation and thereby ensure the welfare and prosperity of the land. So, a prominent feature of this Canaanite cult was sacred prostitution. And we've read about these, you know, these temple prostitutes and so on. Well, this is what they're trying to do, is to get the gods to make their soil fertile and make their animals reproduce. So in the act of temple prostitution, a man identified himself with Baal, the woman with Ashtart, and it was believed that human pairs, by imitating the action of Baal and his partner, could bring the divine pair together in a fertilizing union. Through these ceremonies, farmers could swing into the rhythm of the agricultural world and even keep these rhythms going through the techniques of religious magic. This kind of magic in question is often called sympathetic or imitative magic. Rests on the assumption that when persons imitate the action of the gods, a power is released to bring that action about. And it's very interesting that the Babylonians had that same process, only they called them by different names. The male god was called Tammuz, and the female god was called Ishtar, or Easter. So you can see where some of the rites and ceremonies in our land come from. Just one more thing I wanted to look at here. It says, the purpose of their religion was to preserve and enhance the fertility upon which man was dependent for his existence. That religion sought to control the gods in the interest of human well-being. It was aimed to maintain the harmony and rhythm of the natural order. So the pagans thought they could control the gods by their action, whereas Israel's faith stressed serving God in gratitude for his benevolence and in response to the task which he lays on his people. Yahweh could not be coerced by magic. He could only be trusted or betrayed, obeyed or disobeyed, but in all things his will is sovereign. So you can see the contrast. And you could see that it would be easy for these Israelites who were just truly learning farming after 40 years of wandering to look to these pagan gods. And so God wanted them totally eliminated from the land. Now, although Moses was inspired to repeatedly hammer on these commands from God, we can read subsequent history, as Mr. Mickelson alluded to, and clearly see that Israel failed to carry out God's commands. To one degree or another, Israel was ensnared by the pagan cultures. They failed to exterminate these people, and these ideas were syncretized into their culture. In fact, I won't turn there, but in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 2, it says, "Where are your gods that you had made for yourself?" And of course, it's gods with a small g. "Let them arise if they can save you in this time of your trouble. For according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah." So we can see that Judah was incorporating these local gods into their religion. They were syncretizing it with God's religion. And surprisingly, this archaic, old-fashioned pagan thinking saturates our modern so-called Christian society today. The rites and rituals of Christmas and Easter are prime examples. You know, conservative Christians say, "Put Christ back into Christmas." Well, he was never there in the first place. It's paganism. The Christmas trees, mistletoe, holly wreaths, candles, lights, and bonfires, Easter bunnies and the Easter eggs are all remnants of pagan fertility cults. And they're all glossed over with the name of Christ. And the temple prostitutes, they're available 24 hours a day at the shrine of our own personal home computers. In Revelation 21, verse 4, God says, "Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues." Come out of her, my people. And that's the message of the days of unleavened bread. Many of us at one point in our life had to make the decision to come out of the society we were immersed in. Personally, I was raised in a Catholic family. And I can see that my early life was saturated with pagan concepts. And one thing about being ignorant is the fact that when you're ignorant, you don't know you're ignorant. Right? But I was a zealous Catholic. I participated wholeheartedly in all their doctrines. I prayed to their saints. I memorized rote prayers, some of them even in Latin. I bowed to idols. I set up a green tree inside of our house in the dead of winter, and I decorated it with little fertility symbols. I didn't know what I was doing. And I confessed my sins to a priest. I tried to get my buddies to go to church with me on Sunday. I even missed out on the motorcycle races up at Big Bear every year because they were on Sunday and I had to go to church. So, but back to Deuteronomy, I want to go back to chapter 7 just for a minute, just page back, and notice especially verse 6. Verse 6 of chapter 7 of Deuteronomy says, "You are a holy people to the Lord your God." That means you're sanctified. You're set apart. You're not to be mixing with these Canaanites. "The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth." God wanted a personal, one-on-one relationship. He wanted the land completely cleared of the pagan inhabitants. He wanted no vestige at all of the Baals and the Ashtarts left in the area. He wanted no opportunity for compromise or syncretism. No mixture, no watering down. He wanted no truth mixed with error. So we need to be on guard because this society, just like the Canaanite society, wants to come back into our lives. Again, I won't turn there, but in 2 Corinthians, citing Numbers and Isaiah, it says, "Come out from among them and be you separate, says the Lord." So we need to change. We need to come out, and that's what we're reminded of during the days of unleavened bread. Joshua himself with his friend Caleb both finished their race in grand style. But I want to focus on another finisher today. Among the number of individuals listed in the faith chapter, which is Hebrews 11, there's only two women that are named. One is Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Abraham's the father of the faithful, and his wife was certainly faithful and was included in the faith chapter. But the other woman that was mentioned in Hebrews 11 is Rahab. Rahab the harlot. What a contrast. I'd like to look at her example today. And for that, we'll turn to the book of Joshua. And we'll start in Joshua chapter 2. Joshua 2 in verse 1 says, Joshua the son of Nun set out two men from the acacia grove to spy secretly, saying, go view this land, especially Jericho. Now Joshua was a pretty smart man. He sent these spies out secretly. He didn't tell anybody else about it because he was a spy 40 years ago when these dozen spies were sent out into the land. And they came back with fearful report. And so they had to wander for 40 years, and Joshua had had enough of that. He wanted to be in the promised land, so he sent out the spies secretly, and he was kind of hoping they'd come back and secretly report what was going on. And he was going to invade them anyhow, but he wanted to get the lay of the land himself. So these two spies went, and they came to the house of a harlot named Rahab, and they lodged there. Now, lodging in this place would be a natural place for a visitor in town to go. Imagine yourself a stranger coming into a walled city. You don't want to attract a whole lot of attention. After all, you are a spy. And so you zip into this first place that looks like it you can be accommodated without too many questions being asked. And it's a good place to gossip, good place to gather information, as spies are supposed to do. But the question comes up all the time, was Rahab really a harlot? Because even some commentaries say that, well, that just means she was an innkeeper. It's kind of the same word, harlot means an innkeeper. Well, the Bible says she was a harlot. And after reading a description of the Canaanite religion, you can see that more than likely, in that society, she was. She was a worshiper of the Baals and the Ashtarts, and it was a normal thing, expected thing, of young ladies to be temple prostitutes as they went through their religious training, I suppose. It was even an honorable thing. So I don't think there's too much of a doubt about it. Let's continue reading here. It was told the king of Jericho, so they didn't actually sneak into town after all. The king found out about it. Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country. So the woman took the two men and hid them, and she said, yeah, the men came to see me, but I don't know where they were from. And it happened when the gate was being shut, when it was dark, the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. So they figured they're going back to report to Israel. They're going to go back to the fords of the Jordan, where you could actually cross on foot. As soon as those who were pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. So before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know the Lord has given you the land. The terror of you has fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God, in heaven above and in earth beneath. Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you will also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. And spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all they have, and deliver our lives from death. And so the men answered her, our lives are yours. If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be, when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you. And she let them down by a rope to the window for her houses on the city wall, and she dwelt on the wall. Now I mentioned Hebrews 11. I'll quote it now. It says, by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she received the spies in peace. And James chapter 2 goes on and says, was not Rahab the harlot justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? So Rahab proved her faith by her works. She put her neck on the line. She committed treason against her own country and saved these men's lives because she had faith in their God. Back in verse 11, she said, as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Everybody's hearts melted. But only Rahab had enough faith to act favorably to the spies. And when she said, the Lord your God, he is God. So she acted in faith. And she demonstrated her faith by her works. God had told Israel to slaughter the Canaanites. And here the first one they meet saves their lives. And they promise to save her life. In verse 16, after she let them down, she said to them, go to the mountains. So don't go back to the fords of the Jordan. Head up to the mountains, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned, and afterward you may go your way. Then the men said to her, we will be blameless of this oath of yours which you have made us swear, unless when we come to the land you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you bring your father, your mother, and your brothers, and all your father's household to your own home. And so it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we'll be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head, if a hand is laid on him. Now this episode occurred just prior to Passover. And it could be that the spies had this thought in mind when they told her to bind this scarlet cord in her window. You know, they couldn't really tell her to take a bunch of blood and slather it on their doorposts and her lintels there. But the scarlet cord is reminiscent of that blood. And they also told her to stay indoors. Don't go outside, which is exactly what God told the Israelites on Passover day itself. So in verse 21, we see that she obeyed these spies. She said, according to your word, so be it. She sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. So Rahab had faith. She turned to God for mercy. But the rest of the folks in Jericho hardened their hearts against God and against his people. Now we could go through the next few chapters here and see the miracles of the crossing of the Jordan on dry ground and the destruction of Jericho. But I would just like to reestablish the timing here. Joshua 4, verse 19 mentions how the people came up from the Jordan the 10th day of the first month, and they camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. So on the 10th day, that's the day that the Israelites set the lamb aside to slaughter on Passover. And then if we go forward to chapter 5, verse 10, it says, the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So they're on the west side of the river now. Some people think that the walls of Jericho came tumbling down on this very day, the last day of unleavened bread. I don't know about that either, but it's certainly this time of year, very close to this very day. Joshua 6, verse 22, we see that Joshua sent the same two men whose lives Rahab saved to rescue her and her family. Verse 22 says, Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the country, go to the harlot's house and from there bring out the woman and all she has, as you swore to her. Verse 23, so the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. They brought them all out all her relatives, and left them outside the camp of Israel. Now the camp of Israel was holy. Joshua had told the people to sanctify themselves, to consecrate themselves before the invasion of the land and the attack on Jericho. And so nothing unclean would be allowed to enter the camp. But in verse 25, we'll see that Rahab and her family were eventually accepted into the family of Israel. Verse 25, Joshua spared Rahab and the harlot, her father's household, and all she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, her or her progeny, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Rahab's faith, demonstrated by her works, spared her life. Well, the story of Rahab is certainly an example of living faith. I think it's very inspiring. But I also believe it's an example of hope and of love. I'd like to read a little excerpt here from Expositor's commentary. And they talk about the conversion of Rahab. It's done in better language than I could use, so I'll just read it here. It says, the spies violated God's explicit command that none of the people living in the land were to be spared. Rahab, however, turned to God and sought deliverance. Her experience is proof of the gracious saving purpose of God. His overarching decree is that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. This is one of the most dramatic examples of grace in the Old Testament and is set in bold relief by the questionable aspects of Rahab's profession and her conversion. And I submit that you and I have some questionable aspects of our life as well. But this gives us hope. It gives us hope in God's mercy and His grace. I think it's beautiful. The salvation of Rahab is an example of what God would have done for others also. The king and the other citizens of Jericho knew all she knew, but they did not turn to Israel's God for mercy. The fear that drove her to beg for mercy drove them in their stubborn rebellion. Accordingly, the others were called the disobedient ones in Hebrews chapter 11. So this example of Rahab is an example of hope, and it should instill hope in each one of us who turns from his former ways. Each of us still have need and opportunity to overcome with God's help any sins we might have, any weaknesses might have, as Roger mentioned in the sermonette. Once we recognize them, go to God for help. And here's an example of how merciful He is. We won't be destroyed along with the disobedient if we repent and turn to God in faith and hope. Again, we need to finish strong. Now, I mentioned that her story was one of faith and hope and love. And we know that Rahab was certainly a recipient of God's love. But now I'd like to turn to the New Testament, chapter 1 of Matthew. Matthew chapter 1. And we will see if we can read the rest of the story. Because Matthew chapter 1 is a chapter that contains the genealogy of Jesus Christ through Joseph. In verse 4, it says, Ram begot Amminadab, Amminadab begot Nahshon, Nahshon begot Salmon. Now, Nahshon is a name that we don't read very often. I'm not very familiar with it. But it turns out that Nahshon was actually a brother-in-law to Aaron. His sister apparently married Aaron. And in Numbers chapter 2, he is called the captain of Judah's host. So Nahshon was actually the leading man in the tribe of Judah. Now Salmon here was the son of Nahshon. So he must have been a well-known and respected young man. Now, could Salmon have been chosen by Joshua to be one of the spies that he sent into Canaan? It seems like it well could have been. Could he have been the one whose life Rahab saved and then returned to rescue her? The Bible doesn't say, but I like to think that he was, because I'm also rather romantic at heart. In verse 5a here, it says, Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab. So however, whoever Salmon happened to be, seems he was a prince of Judah, and he came to love Rahab and to marry her. They became the great-great-grandparents of David, and they were included in the list of forebearers of Jesus Christ. So I think that's a special finish. So this morning we've noticed the example of Joshua and Caleb, who seem to run their whole race well. Those two men have no negative reports about them in anything that you read about them in the Bible. Joshua and Caleb started their race well, and they finished it well. We've also read the story of one who didn't start life under the best of circumstances. She was immersed in pagan society, but she recognized the true God and repented of her own ways. She entrusted her future to God. She became a beautiful example of faith and hope and love that can be fulfilled in the lives of each one of us and everyone who repents of his own ways and accepts the Passover sacrifice of Jesus Christ. No matter how we start our race, every one of us can finish strong.